And hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of Double Cross Radio, coming to you live from the state of Jefferson, or the Jefferson Republic, or however you want to see it. And I'm Chuck Horton, and I'm joined tonight by my co-host Drew Lamb and our special guest Dennis Linthicum, and we have a great show for you tonight about the myth of the robber barons. It's all about history, economics, and I think you'll be able to see as we go through this a lot of things that were happening back in the 19th century didn't end very well, and they're still going on today, and they're still not ending very well. And so it seems like a lot of things we don't learn because we don't really learn history the right way. We learn the spun version of it, which doesn't teach us the lessons we need to learn. So I'll stop babbling. And Drew, how are you doing today?
Hey, I'm doing great, Chuck. Thanks for bringing us in there.
Yeah, and Dennis, welcome back to the show. I don't think you need much of an introduction at this point in time, but Dennis, I'll just give you a short one. He was a candidate for Congress in the 2nd Congressional District of Oregon in the primaries, and he lost his primary bid to the incumbent, Greg Walden. Boo, Greg Walden. And he's currently a Klamath County commissioner, which is he does a great job there. Which we had commissioners of his stature in Jackson County. And he comes on the show quite frequently. We're trying to get him on here the last Thursday of every month to discuss stuff. We try and pick out topics that are kind of in his wheelhouse so we can make use of his expertise. And he does have a degree in economics. And so, Dennis, welcome to the show.
You bet. It's always fun to get together with you guys and just hash out some of these ideas. These are important things for people to recognize and learn.
We think so. So we do this for free.
Well, yeah. You know, there are great economic truths. My daughter, she's 30. Her husband's 32. They were saying she was saying, you know, Dad, you ought to put ask Dad on some kind of podcast or something, and just answer questions about economics for people who don't know any better. And I thought that was a cute little comment coming from her, but it's true. A lot of folks don't understand how these economic principles work, and they expect government to come in and solve a problem. But politicians can't do anything without first taking resources out of your pocket.
Yes, and it's at times it gets rather disastrous, and it's really a misallocation of resources, because despite what any politician will tell you about, they have a better insight into how resources should be allocated. They don't. I think you could go through the first 100 people in the Boston telephone book and they'd have better ideas than any politicians ever come up with. They have no special insight into anything except who's their donors and how they're going to get reelected so they can make more money. That's pretty much it. Anyway, let's get on to our topic. Drew, you were going to start off with Cornelius Vanderbilt tonight. Now, Cornelius Vanderbilt has been dubbed one of the robber barons. I don't necessarily agree with that, but Drew's going to tell you a little about him and maybe why he got that distinction or was labeled such. So Drew, go ahead. Take off.
Well, you know, upon researching this guy, you know, and learning a bit more about him, I really admire him. He's not a robber baron. There's nothing robber about this guy. He's wasn't a criminal. He was an entrepreneur, a very creative entrepreneur. And, you know, and he came from an entrepreneurial family. You know, back in the day, the fruit didn't fall far from the tree. Today it seems to fall and then roll down the hill, I think, from my experience. But I wish I'd been born into the position that he was born into, but a lot of people who are don't know what to do, you know, with it. And you know, I know some people in my family who squandered away their genetic lottery winnings, and And I would say that Cornelius Vanderbilt was not one of those guys. His father actually operated a ferry in New York, and he started working for his father at the age of 16. There's a pretty good biography, brief biography about Vanderbilt on Wikipedia, actually, of all places. I'm going to present a lot of the information just right off of here because it's pretty good. Cornelius Vanderbilt was born in Staten Island, New York, to Cornelius Vanderbilt and Phoebe Hand. He began working on his father's ferry in New York Harbor as a boy, quitting school at the age of 11. At the age of 16, Vanderbilt decided to start his own ferry service. According to one version of events, he borrowed $100 from his mother to purchase a shallow draft two-masted sailing vessel, and he christened it the Swiftsure. And there's another story, however, that actually belonged to his father, and that he split the profit. I think that's probably more likely what happened. And he began his business ferrying freight and passengers between Staten Island and Manhattan. And he was given the nickname by other ferry captains as the Commodore, because he worked so hard with so much zeal. And he married his first cousin, Sophia Johnson, December 19th in 1813. And in addition to running his ferry, he bought his brother-in-law, John DeForest, schooner called the Charlotte. And he partnered with his father with that operation. And then shortly thereafter, Thomas Gibbons asked Vanderbilt to captain his steamboat between New Jersey and New York. And Vanderbilt kept his business going. This seems to be a theme with Vanderbilt, and I appreciate this. He didn't have all of his eggs in one basket. And he juggled a lot of duties, worked for several people, but he always had his own business going. And this is how I work. So it takes a lot of things, a lot of focus on a lot of different things to be a successful entrepreneur. And sometimes, well, you can see the way that things panned out for him. It was very wise for him to make decisions like that. He ended up becoming Gibbons's business manager. This is where things get interesting. When Vanderbilt entered his new position, Gibbons was fighting against a monopoly on steamboats in New York waters, granted by the New York State Legislature to the politically influential patrician Robert Livingston and steamboat designer Robert Fulton. Now, Robert Livingston was a founding father. You know, he was one of the five members who drafted the Declaration of Independence. And then he never actually signed it. He was recalled by his state. But he was a very well-connected guy. And so Livingston Fulton died by the time Vanderbilt went to work for the Gibbons, and the monopoly continued in the hands of Livingston's heirs, who granted a license to Aaron Ogden to run a ferry between New York and New Jersey. Gibbons launched his steamboat venture because of his personal dispute with Ogden. Oh, I want to back up for a minute with Robert Livingston. He also negotiated the Louisiana Purchase. So this was an extremely influential person, and who used his power and his connections to get the state granted monopoly to operate a ferry or a steamboat, and to ferry passengers and freight.
It's like getting the monopoly to run all the taxis in New York City or something.
Right. So Gibbons launched his steamboat venture because of a personal dispute with Ogden, whom he had hoped to bankrupt. To accomplish this, he undercut prices and also brought a landmark case, Gibbons versus Ogden, to the United States Supreme Court to overturn the monopoly. Working for Gibbons, Vanderbilt learned to operate a large and complicated business. He moved to New Brunswick, New Jersey, a stop on Gibbons' line between New York and Philadelphia, where his wife, Sophia, operated a very profitable inn. Using the proceeds to feed, clothe, and educate their children, Vanderbilt also proved a quick study in legal matters, representing Gibbons in meetings with lawyers. He also went to Washington, D.C. to hire Daniel Webster to argue the case before the Supreme Court. Vanderbilt appealed his own case against monopoly to the Supreme Court, which was next on the docket after Gibbons versus Ogden. The court, however, never heard Vanderbilt's case because on March 2nd, 1824, it ruled in Gibbons' favor, saying that states had no power to interfere with interstate commerce. Go figure. Maybe we need to go over this lesson once again.
I'm going to interrupt just a second.
Go for it.
It's a little short. He made the right decision for the wrong reason. Nobody should have that right, but he said the right belonged only with the federal government, not with
sure. That's another issue. The case is still considered a landmark ruling and is considered the basis for much of the prosperity the United States later enjoyed. He enjoyed a great career as a steamboat entrepreneur. After Thomas Gibbons died in 1826, Vanderbilt worked for Gibbons' son William until 1829. Though he had always run his business on the side, he worked entirely for himself. Step by step, he started lines between New York and the surrounding region. First, he took over Gibbons' ferry to New Jersey, then switched to Western Long Island Sound. In 1831, he took over his brother Jacob's line to Pickskill, New York, on the lower Hudson River. That year, he faced opposition by a steamboat operated by Daniel Drew, who forced Vanderbilt to buy him out. Impressed, Vanderbilt became a secret partner with Drew for the next 30 years so that the two men would have an incentive to avoid competing with each other. That's what I call co-opetition. On November 8, 1833, Vanderbilt was nearly killed in the Hightstown rail accident on the Camden and Amboy Railroad in New Jersey. After the train, also on the train, was former President John Quincy Adams. That was the son of the John Adams. In 1834, Vanderbilt competed on the Hudson River against a steamboat monopoly between New York and Albany. Using the name the People's Line, he used the populist language associated with Democratic President Andrew Jackson to get popular support for his business. At the end of the year, the monopoly paid him a large amount to stop competing, and he switched his operations to Long Island Sound. During the 1830s, textile mills were built in large numbers in New England as the United States experienced an industrial revolution. Some of the first railroads in the United States were built from Boston to Long Island Sound to connect with steamboats that ran to New York. By the end of the decade, Vanderbilt dominated the steamboat business on the Sound and began to take over the management of the connecting railroads. In the 1840s, he launched a campaign to take over the most attractive of these lines, the New York, Providence, and Boston Railroad, popularly known as the Stonington. By cutting fares on competing lines, Vanderbilt drove down the Stonington stock price and took over the presidency of the company in 1847, the first of the many railroads he would head. During these years, Vanderbilt also operated many other businesses. He bought large amounts of real estate in Manhattan and Staten Island and took over the Staten Island Ferry in 1838. It was in the 1830s when he was first referred to as Commodore, and then the highest rank at the time in the United States Navy. A common nickname for important steamboat entrepreneurs is stuck to Vanderbilt alone by the end of the 1840s. Actually, I think he was called that when he was a teenager, and it was in jest. Ocean-going steamship lines was the next step in his career. When the California Gold Rush began in 1849, Vanderbilt switched from regional steamboat lines to ocean-going steamships. Many of the migrants to California and almost all of the gold returning to the East Coast went by steamship to Panama, where mule trains and canoes provided transportation across the isthmus. The Panama Railroad was soon built to provide faster crossing. Vanderbilt proposed a canal across Nicaragua, which was closer to the United States and was spanned most of the way across by Lake Nicaragua and the San Juan River. In the end, he could not attract enough investment to build the canal, but he did start a steamship line to Nicaragua and founded the Accessory Transit Company to carry passengers across Nicaragua by steamboat on the lake and river with a 12-mile carriage road between the Pacific port of San Juan del Sur and Virgin Bay on Lake Nicaragua. And in 1852, a dispute with Joseph L. White, a partner in the Accessory Transit Company, led to a battle in which Vanderbilt forced the company to buy his ships for an inflated price. In early 1853, he took his family on a grand tour of Europe in his steamship yacht, the North Star. While he was away, White conspired with Charles Morgan, Vanderbilt's erstwhile ally, to betray him and deny him money he was owed by the Accessory Transit Company. When Vanderbilt returned from Europe, he retaliated with a rival line to California, cutting prices until he forced Morgan and White to pay him off. He then turned to transatlantic steamship lines, running in opposition to the heavily subsidized Collins line, headed by Edward K. Collins. Vanderbilt eventually drove the Collins line into extinction. During the 1850s, he also bought control of a major shipyard and the Allaire Iron Works, a leading manufacturer of marine steam engines in Manhattan. In November 1855, Vanderbilt began to buy control of Accessory Transit once again. That same year, the military adventurer William Walker took control of Nicaragua. Edmund Randolph, a close friend of Walker, coerced the Accessory Transit's San Francisco agent Cornelius K. Garrison into opposing Vanderbilt. Randolph convinced Walker to annul the charter of the Accessory Transit Company and give the transit rights and company steamboats to him. Randolph then sold them to Garrison. Garrison brought Charles Morgan in New York into the plan. Vanderbilt took control of the company just before these developments were announced. When he tried to convince the U.S. and English governments to help restore the company to its rights and property, they refused. So he negotiated with Costa Rica, which, along with other Central American republics, had declared war on Walker. Vanderbilt sent a man to Costa Rica who led a raid that captured the steamboats on the San Juan River, cutting Walker off from his reinforcements from the United States. Walker was forced to give up and was conducted out of the country by a U.S. Navy officer, but the new Nicaraguan government refused to allow Vanderbilt to restart the transit business. So he started a line by way of Panama, eventually constructing a monopoly on the California steamship business. When the Civil War began in 1861, Vanderbilt attempted to donate his largest steamship, the Vanderbilt, to the Union Navy. Secretary of the Navy Gideon Welles refused it, thinking its operation and maintenance too expensive for what he expected to be a short war. Vanderbilt had little choice but to lease it to the War Department at prices set by shipbrokers. When the Confederate ironclad Virginia, popularly known in the North as the Merrimack, wrought havoc with the Union blockading squadron at Hampton Roads, Virginia, Vanderbilt had little choice but to lease it to the War Department. Secretary of War Edwin Shanton and President Abraham Lincoln called on Vanderbilt for help. This time, he succeeded in donating the Vanderbilt to the Union Navy, equipping it with a ram and staffing it with handpicked officers. It helped bottle up the Virginia, after which Vanderbilt converted it into a cruiser to hunt for the Confederate commerce raider Alabama, captained by Raphael Sims. Vanderbilt also outfitted a major expedition to New Orleans, but he suffered a personal loss when his youngest and favorite son and heir apparent, George Washington Vanderbilt, a graduate of the United States Military Academy, fell ill and died without ever seeing combat. Then he started building a railroad empire. Though Vanderbilt had relinquished his presidency of the Stonington Railroad during the California Gold Rush, he took an interest in several railroads during the 1850s, serving on the board of directors for the Erie Railway, the Central Railroad of New Jersey, the Hartford and the New Haven, and the New York and Harlem, popularly known as the Harlem. In 1863, Vanderbilt took control of the Harlem in a famous stock market corner and was elected its president. He later explained that he wanted to show that he could take this railroad, which was generally considered worthless, and make it valuable. It had a key advantage. It was the only steam railroad to enter the center of Manhattan, running down 4th Avenue, later Park Avenue, to a station on 26th Street, where it connected with a horse-drawn streetcar. From Manhattan, it ran up to Chatham Four Corners, New York, where it had connections to the railroads running east and west. Vanderbilt brought his eldest son, Billy, in as vice president of the Harlem. Billy had had a nervous breakdown early in life, and his father had sent him to a farm on Staten Island. But he proved himself a good businessman and eventually became the head of the Staten Island Railway. Though the Commodore had once scorned him, he was impressed by his son's success and eventually made him operational manager of all his railroad lines. In 1864, the Commodore sold his last ships, concentrating on the railroads. New York Central and Hudson Railroad was another of his operations. Once in charge of the Harlem, Vanderbilt encountered conflicts with connecting lines. In each case, the strife ended in a battle that Vanderbilt won. He bought control of the Hudson River Railroad in 1864, the New York Central Railroad in 1867, and the Lakeshore and Michigan Southern Railway in 1869. He later bought the Canada Southern as well. In 1870, he consolidated two of his key lines into the New York Central and Hudson River Railroad, one of the first giant corporations in American history. In 1869, he directed the Harlem to begin construction of the Grand Central Depot on 42nd Street in Manhattan. It was finished in 1871 and served as his line's terminus in New York. He sank the tracks on 4th Avenue in a cut that later became a tunnel, and the 4th Avenue became Park Avenue. The depot was replaced by Grand Central Terminal in 1913. In 1868, Vanderbilt fell into a dispute with Daniel Drew, who became treasurer of the Erie Railway. To get revenge, he tried to corner Erie stock, which led to the so-called Erie War. This brought him into direct conflict with Jay Gould and financier James Fisk Jr., who had just joined Drew on the Erie board. They defeated the corner by issuing watered stock in defiance of state law, which restricted the number of shares a company could issue. But Gould bribed the legislature to legalize the new stock. Vanderbilt used the leverage of a lawsuit to get his losses back, but he and Gould became public enemies. Gould never got the better of Vanderbilt in any other important business matter, but he often embarrassed Vanderbilt, who uncharacteristically lashed out at Gould in public. By contrast, Vanderbilt befriended his and other foes after their fights ended, including Drew and Cornelius Garrison. And I think that's one of the most telling things about Vanderbilt's personality, that even with some of the men who had bested him, or even some of the men that he had defeated in business, he always maintained sound business relationships if it was opportunistic.
Yeah, he was a man of integrity. He did what he said he was going to do, and he didn't cheat to do it.
Well, sometimes it just doesn't make sense to hold a grudge in some cases, you know.
Yeah, I'm gonna.
Vanderbilt isn't as good a story as James J. Hill is. Vanderbilt, you know, both of these guys, many of the railroads, most of the railroads, except for in particular James Hill, as you were reading, you could see that Vanderbilt wasn't afraid to use protective tariffs or congressional intervention or national banks and government loans to do what he needed to do in terms of that. But James J. Hill is an individual who did the entire line without benefit of government grants or loans. And this is large capital investment. There's thousands of miles of track. There's boxcars. There's switching equipment. There's stations and freight depots and reserves of wood or coal or whatever fuel they were using to drive their steam engines. These are gigantic operations. And that rail system that James Hill created is really one of the better stories, because he did it by completely avoiding government subsidies and proving that it could be done without subsidies, proving that he could be successful, quote, and could be, he was known, quote, as an empire builder because of his, St. Paul Pacific Railroad operating in the Minnesota area. And it was just a fabulous railroad.
Yeah, in fact, I think one of the bridges for that railroad still exists. It's a granite bridge across the Mississippi up there in Minnesota. I think it still exists. It did for a long time anyway, if it doesn't today.
What we'll see as we describe railroads is we'll see that government intervention always distorts the market. Government intervention always skews and drives men to do things that they wouldn't normally do. Like if the government is going to subsidize you on mileage of track, then you ought to lay the most curviest line in the world, go around
Which
this building and around the front building and back, because you'll get paid more per mile, quote, because you put in more miles. And that's not how a businessman would lay track. He would lay track in a straight line at a low grade. And so you have men who are, you know, thinking about how to do it efficiently, like James J. Hill, and then men who are using the deep pocket of their funding brothers in the public sphere. And so we always have to keep back in mind that when the federal government is promoting something, it's bad for the economy because of the distortion, and it's bad for the taxpayer because they're the ones who have to pony up.
And they either pony it up in taxes or higher fares. It's just one or the other. I wanted to finish up on the Cornelius Vanderbilt, because he was he was one of the people who was labeled as the robber baron, and he built this entire empire. And most of the people that he vanquished, and you could even tell, even in the Wikipedia thing that Drew was reading, when he's talking about his battles with Edward Collins and the Collins steamer line, he said he drove him out of business. Well, that is nothing could be further from the truth. The Collins steamship line never operated at a profit, and the only reason it stayed in business is because Congress kept giving him subsidies. When he started this line in 1849, the English had subsidized their own steamship line, the Cunard line, and it was making trips between England and the United States frequently. And so the Congress thought, well, we need to compete with that, so we're going to start our own line here. And they got they solicited different people, and Edward Collins lobbied them with a proposal that he wanted a $385,000 a year subsidy. Now, that was at the time, that was about 3% of the national debt at that time in 1849. So that was a lot of money. Think of what 3% of 18 trillion is. It's a lot of money. Anyway, then he asked for $3 million to build 5 ships that would, he could keep them in, you know, going back and forth, so there'd be ships landing and taking off all the time. They could make the transit took a little bit less than 2 weeks to go across there, so he'd think he'd always have, you know, every week some ship would be taking off and heading for one direction or the other. Because of cost overruns, because he kept making these ships into something, they really he went all out. You know, he's one of those guys that, well, I'm going to build this ship and we're going to do it right. So he'd always put a lot of money into it that really wasn't needed. And they were built, these ships were built on taxpayer money from probably the poorest people in America. And what ended up happening is rich people got subsidies to travel back and forth between the United States and Europe. So that's kind of how things still work today to some extent. But he only ended up building 3 ships because he didn't have enough money to build all 5 of them. And he still had a fairly decent schedule going, but he lost money. And so the next year in 1850, he came back to Congress and he says, you know, I just can't make it on this $385,000. I need a little bit more. So $400,000. And they said, okay, you can have it. They voted for it. You know, they said, this is really necessary. These are great ships. We're competing with England now. We're just sticking them in the eye. This is what we need to do. So he went out there and came back the next year in 1851. He said, well, We're still hemorrhaging red ink. I think I'm going to need a $500,000 subsidy to run these things. And Congress, there may have been a few people that spoke out against it, but they still overwhelmingly approved it. And they gave him this higher subsidy. 1852, guess what? He came back, his hand out, asking for more money. So he got a $600,000 subsidy. Now, remember, this is in a time when $20 bought an ounce of gold. So this is real money. $600,000 is a lot of money. And he still hadn't even made a payment on the $300 million that he had been given to build these ships. they approved a $600,000 subsidy, and in 1853, they approved a $700,000 subsidy. Came around to the next year, he decided that just going up $100,000 wasn't going to do it, so he asked for $850,000. Actually, I think he asked for a little bit more, but he settled for $850,000 because what he was really asking for, they wouldn't approve. Cornelius Vanderbilt was watching all this, and he said, I would like to get in on some of this because I think I could run these ships for a profit. So I'll do this for half the price that Collins is doing. I'll do it for, it'd be $425,000. And there, you can go back in the congressional record and you can read some of these speeches, but several senators, congressmen, they got up and they gave impassioned speeches about how Cornelius Vanderbilt didn't know how to run an ocean liner company, even though he was running one very successfully around to California for the gold rush. And they thought that they needed to keep their, you know, that they had hitched their wagon to Collins. They needed to stay the course, to stay with Collins and to see him through. And these guys, I'm sure, were getting kickbacks. I just, you know, there's no mention of it anywhere in history, but I am positive they were getting money from him. That's why he was always buying their votes. He was, some of that subsidy had to be to get votes for the next year when he needed a more subsidy. I'm sure of it. And I could be wrong. This is my opinion. But it just seems like these things, sometimes they put on different costumes, but they always act the same. So anyway, he denied Vanderbilt his request, his bid, and he had offered to save him $425,000. And they said, no, we're going to stay with Collins. So he said, well, if that's what you're going to do, I'm going to start my own line going across the ocean, and I'm going to I'm not going to take any of your money, and I'm going to do what he's doing at a lower price, and I'm going to make money. And he did. And the first thing he did is he built a ship that wasn't quite so lavish and didn't have all the furnishings that Collins' ship did, but he offered portage across the Atlantic for a lot less. He had first class, second class, third class seats. Now, third class wasn't very great. I mean, you kind of crammed into it. It was kind of like the Pilgrims coming over on the Mayflower. It was pretty tight quarters. It wasn't a lot of, you just kind of sat in your chair and you could get up and walk around once in a while, but there wasn't a lot of room for it, and you maybe slept sitting down. But the price was very reasonable. People without a lot of means could make that trip. They could emigrate to the United States. They could, they didn't have a lot of cash to spend, but they could still make the journey. So it was open to a lot of more people. His ships were always full. The first voyage he made across the Atlantic, he wanted to get some publicity. And so he thought the best way to do it was to set the record for the fastest journey. So he just takes off, and they just had the thing going full blast the whole way around. Now, he had great steam engines. They had put that part of the ship together very, very well. Top flight, everything was awesome in that. A lot of these ships, by the way, were still wood at this time, and they had to be caulked. And if they were to leak, it would be a real problem. And he made sure all those things were ship shape. I mean, he didn't want to lose his investment. He had a lot of money tied up in this ship. He didn't want it down at the bottom of the ocean. But anyway, his ship went around and it set a new record for that. And he got a lot of notoriety in the press. The newspapers were all putting in headlines about how Vanderbilt's ship was the fastest ship on the Atlantic Ocean. So he got a lot of free publicity. He's very smart. That trip cost him. It wasn't really an economical trip. He burned a lot more coal than he should have, and that's kind of expensive. But that publicity, how can you? That publicity was worth probably 3 or 4 boatloads full of coal, and that was awesome. It just shows you how smart this guy was. And then he turned around and having these low fares. He had ships were always full all the time, and he made money on every voyage. I'm going to repeat that. He made a profit on every voyage. Collins was being subsidized for almost $1 million a year at this point. And Vanderbilt was making money. So that thing in Wikipedia about Vanderbilt drove Collins out of business is not true. Collins was just didn't know how to run his ships. As an illustration of this, he was embarrassed because Vanderbilt's ship had gone faster. And so he was trying to have his ships make their routes a little quicker. And he was telling them to go faster. And he actually lost his wife and two children when they were on one of his ships when it was struck by another ship, and they were going too fast in a really foggy situation when they should have been going very slow. And the ship was ruptured in a couple places below the waterline. They did not have watertight compartments, and it filled up and sank. And the captain tried to make it to harbor before it sank, but they sank about 15 miles offshore, and his family perished. And I think that kind of shook him up a little bit. But within a few days, he received news that another one of his ships, and remember, he only had three, another one of his ships was missing. It didn't show up. And they didn't know what happened to that. For years, they didn't know what happened to it. In 1991, they discovered the wreckage of that ship off the coast of Wales. So they didn't get very far out of port before it was wrecked. And it probably wasn't maintained very well because they were losing money and they were trying to cut costs. And they weren't trying to protect their investment because he would always just go to Congress to get more money. In fact, what he did when he lost those two ships, he went back to Congress and says, "I need some money to build another ship. If we're going to keep this thing going, I need to build another ship." And they gave him more money. Can you believe this? So he built this huge monstrosity of a ship. It was probably the most glorious ship that had been built in terms of the furnishings. If you have time, you can read about it. Historical accounts. It had mahogany cabinets and had woods imported from all over the world decorating things. But they built it so fast, it wasn't properly caulked. It takes off on its first voyage across the ocean, and actually it was so unseaworthy the passengers had to help out with some of the bailing of the water. They had to man pumps and pump water out because it was leaking like a sieve, and it barely made it across. And people got up, they pulled into port, the people came off that ship, and they were going down. Bert Folsom in that talk he gave, people were going down kissing the ground, "Oh, we made it, we're safe." I mean, they'd been delivered by God in their mind. And no one wanted to go back on that ship. It had a horrible reputation. It was such a failure. They had to scrap the thing. They sold it for scrap. Out of over $1 million it took to build that ship, he was able to reclaim $10,000. And he took that $10,000 and went back to Congress to ask them for more money. And finally, they had had enough. Finally. And so I ask you people, who was the robber baron? Was it Cornelius Vanderbilt or was it Edward Collins? Who was the person that, you know, took all this money and gave nothing, almost nothing back in return? I mean, it's just, was it Cornelius Vanderbilt who always was one in the markets he competed in by offering more product at a lower price than his competitors? And that's why he always won, is he would work on lower profit margins. He worked with better stuff. He worked with, sometimes on his ferries, he wouldn't charge anything at all. He wanted to get a bunch of people on the ferries. And so he would give them free food and you'd charge them a fare, or he'd give them no fare and make them buy the food that was on the boat. So he would do eat one or the other, and he would make money. But his ships were always full, and he always made money. By the way, this is another side note. Cornelius Vanderbilt is the person who invented the potato chip, and he sold those on his ships.
Did he have cappuccino flavored?
I don't think so, but I'm sure he had. He was the first, so he had the only potato chips for quite a while. But you know who was the real robber baron there? I vote for Collins being the real robber baron. I vote for Cornelius Vanderbilt being a person who made his wealth by serving others.
Actually, here let me throw an interesting idea. The Collins couldn't have done what he did without the corrupt politicians that were warping the notion of what the federal government is supposed to be for. If it wasn't for, if you think about politics way back in the 1870s, which is about the time frame we're talking about, 1870s, 1890s, from the Civil War forward, maybe from the 1850s in front of the Civil War to a certain extent. But during the Civil War, the greenbacks, the national banks made it onto the scene. So the greenback and national bank, remember, state banks had to have a tax. There was a 10% tax on notes coming out of state banks. The federal bank could do issue notes and loans and subsidies without any taxes associated with it. You know, kind of think of it as being tax-free. Well, in that case, people are now going to, they're incentivized to no longer deal with the Missouri State Bank or the Michigan State Bank, but they're instead going to go to the federal branch. The federal branch is then got sort of a monopoly for concentrating wealth. If you think about the way a bank works, it's in a city, it's in an industrial location. It kind of is a means of concentrating wealth because it's receiving deposits and it's making loans and it's got this little bit of enterprise in its own right sitting there in a specific location. And these guys are figuring out on a map which way they want to go. Are they going to use the canal system in the rivers and do steam like we were describing, or are they going to go up on land and use railroads and lay track and get things going? And the government, wanting to, you know, do a good deed, starts influencing the construction by men in this state or men in that state volunteering this subsidy or that subsidy. All of those subsidies came out of the taxpayers' pocket. And so the guys who were on one side taking the subsidy, they're not the real crooks. The special interests who are lobbying for the subsidy, they might be the crooks. And the guys who are receiving the subsidy maybe are secondary crooks, but the primary crook is the guy who's reaching into the public wallet and taking that money, that resource, that capital, and allowing it to go out the door to all of these special groups. Anytime the government picks a winner and chooses a loser, there, and I would guess that would be most of the time, government can't be as efficient as the guys who learn the hard way how to build a railroad. That anytime the government is on that path, you and I are about to get swallowed alive.
That's exactly right. And it hasn't changed in 150 years.
Yeah.
Well, we have, Dennis started us on the railroad a little bit earlier, and I'm just going to reinforce what you just said by talking about the Credit Mobilière scandal. I don't say that right. Dennis, you pronounced it earlier when we were before the show.
Well, yeah, I don't know that I'm saying it right, but it's Credit Mobilière, you know, because it's...
Okay, Credit Mobilière. Now, what that was is they formed a construction company to build the railroad for Union Pacific. And this guy named Thomas Durant was the guy that did it, and he was a real schemer. He was the kind of person that had no integrity, and he was the kind of person that in a free market would never succeed because no one would want to have anything to do with him because he's a schemer. He's always trying to get the advantage over somebody through some kind of a nefarious means. I mean, he doesn't play by any kind of rules. He doesn't do what he says, and he doesn't ever act in ways that businessmen with integrity would act. So, but within government, he finds an ally, and he actually gets legislation passed to make this construction company legal when it really wasn't legal to do it this way. The ways that he wanted to do business weren't considered proper in those days, but he just kind of rammed it through and got special legislation to say it was okay, and he was able to do it. He had a crony whose name was Herbert Hoxie, and he got him to submit a bid, which he probably filled out for him, to build the Union Pacific. Now, this guy, I don't know if he was a actual railroad construction guy or just somebody who pretended to be one and could talk a good game or really knew what he was talking about and decided this is an easy way to make a lot of money. I don't know exactly anything too much about this guy, but I do know that this company that was made to be the contractor to build this railroad, they were basically, I would say they were a super retail operation. They would buy all their materials and pay for their labor at their cost, and they would mark it up several times to the Union Pacific, which then would be reimbursed by the government for the costs of rails and labor, and besides the land grants that they got and everything else. So he realized the game and how it was going to be played and how he could manipulate things to maximize the profit. Now, these guys in the construction company, they had no risk. They bought their equipment and materials and labor, and they marked it up 5, 6, 7, 8 times, 10 times, whatever, and the government paid for it to the Union Pacific, and Union Pacific would then pay them. This was very profitable.
And actually, it's worth noting that congressmen, there was a giant scandal after this Congressmen took Credit Mobilier stock at par value. Then when they got the contract to build for Union Pacific, Union Pacific was then pouring. Union Pacific was never a big moneymaker, but the construction company that was doing all the work on the landscape, they were the guys making money. And all the Congress, so now the value of the stock goes through the roof, and all those congressmen, of course, got their rewards straight out of the contracts that were issued in the subsidy side with Union Pacific. So it's a fascinating story.
Yeah, and the congressman involved, the first one to get involved, he kind of figured out what was going on, I think, and he wanted in on the deal, and he and his brother for a while deposed Durant on the board, and Durant got back in control and they decided to work together. This guy's name was Oakes Ames. And I am sure I was at the second congressional district PCP convention to nominate people to go to the national convention for Republicans. And there was a guy named Ames, and I'm sure he said he was a descendant of Oakes Ames.
Yeah, he was a his name is Ames. His name must be Ames Cartwright, but the guy he's referring to that he's a descendant of was a great constitutionalist, you know, a real conservative, and his name was Fisher Ames, and Ames Cartwright, I think. I can't remember Ames' last name, but anyway, Fisher Ames is, you know, a great, great, great somewhere in his line. And okay. Fisher Ames, if you pick up some of Fisher Ames' writing, he is a fantastic conservative.
Okay. Well, that's good. I think better of this person then. But they get going, and people start to figure out what's going on. There was two senators and 9 representatives that received these kickback handouts, and they were all people that dealt with regulating the railroads. And they were in charge of policy and approving requests and things like this. So they had greased the wheels to make sure that everything would roll their way. And eventually people started to figure this out, and it was a huge scandal. And it was just really huge. And we want to compare these guys, who I would consider to be robber barons, consider these people and compare them to James J. Hill, who, as Dennis was talking about, he built his railroad without a cent of public money. He bought every right-of-way he needed. He built his railroad to last because it was his investment. It was his money in there. He didn't want to replace track. on the Union Pacific, they would lay their track over ice because they wanted to get that subsidy. And then when it would fall apart, when the ice melted, they'd go back and relay it again and get the same subsidy again. So they didn't care. They didn't have anything. They didn't have any skin in the game. James J. Hill had his entire fortune was wrapped up in this railroad. And he also wanted, he realized that just building a railroad isn't going to make you money unless you have people that need to use it. So he would, people that wanted to go out and settle and start a farm somewhere and whatever, he would only charge them $10 to drive, you know, to ride out there. He would, sometimes he would bring over, I think he brought 1,000 head of cattle and he distributed it to farmers along his route because he wanted them to raise beef, and he'd ship it back. He would make money shipping the products back to Chicago, to the meat yards there.
If you think about it, this is really pretty good logic. You take a 100-pound calf and you ship him, and you can put them in a boxcar and they're lightweight. They're only 100 pounds each. Then when you bring them back in, 18 months, they're 1,000 pounds each. This is a pretty good deal, and you're charging all the way back to the meat shop in Chicago. Armor was set up in Chicago. And it was the great meat packing capital of America, because all the railroads went there. The steel was created there with Carnegie running the steel mill, and then Armour builds his meat packing plant there, because of course there's plenty of steel. And therefore there's plenty of railroads and there's plenty of this kind of concentration going on. So it's a fantastic, what a brilliant guy to think about how to make money by helping people get started, creating that entrepreneurial spirit, and then allowing them to prosper and bring you along for the ride.
Yeah, and he would set up things like experimental farms where they would try out new kinds of seeds and different varieties and what would grow best in that climate. And he always, when he'd build a new section of railroad, he would always they'd map out the best route so it would have the easiest grade. He found Lewis and Clark's secret passageway through the Rockies, which was a tremendous savings. It saved him. I saved him lots of mileage, and he ended up building a railroad to Seattle that was 115 miles shorter than the heavily subsidized Northern Pacific, which went bankrupt and almost immediately because the Northern Pacific didn't have anybody on its route. He thought, the guy that built that thought a lot of people would go there and they would want to go in as tourists. They just want to go and look at the all the pretty sights out of the train windows, and that he couldn't ever ship anything on his railroad because there wasn't anybody living along his rail line. And the guy was kind of he's trying to run his rail line from New York City, and he didn't understand what it was, what was going on out there. There wasn't anything to ship. There weren't enough people to fill up his trains, and so it was very unprofitable. James J. Hill, on the other hand, he had it all figured out. He understood what it took to make a living, and he made his fortune by serving others, giving people what they want at a better price and with better service, a better product. And he would do things like give people discounts for contracting with him, and if they would guarantee him that they would ship all their stuff on his line, he'd give them a discount because he would have their business all year round. He wouldn't have to go and haggle with them each time. So they would just do a contract for a year.
What's great about his railroad, he basically went from Lake Superior, where we had access to the Atlantic and to shipping to bring stock in, all the way to the Puget Sound on the West Coast. And if you think about, connecting those two waterways, it's not the Erie Canal, it's a land canal built on rails, and he built it all one piece at a time, accumulating smaller rails that were already laid down, and targeting cities and low-grade, easily buildable straight-line rail And he was extremely profitable. There's a quote, I can't remember where I saw the quote. He has this quote where he says something like, the pretty scenes through the Rockies aren't don't mean as much to me as getting goods to market.
Yeah. And he also had a lot of spur lines that he would build. When he would go to an area, then he would make that a hub, and he would spur lines out to other communities. So he doesn't just he was developing that whole region for the people who lived there, giving them access to all the markets in the world. And that's an awesome thing that he did. And there's no way that he was a robber baron. He was a hero. And so, you know, we have the robber barons are the guys like Leland Stanford, who was so corrupt. I mean, he'd used his political power and influence to keep other competing railroads out of California. He actually became a politician. He became elected to office, and he was even more ruthless then. And he had a small committee of people, and they kind of took care of their own part of the graft, and they just monopolized the markets. They made people pay their price if they wanted to ship anything, and they were ruthless, and they were not nice people at all. The fact that he donated all this land and started a private university with his name, I guess it makes people think that he was a great man, but he wasn't. He was a criminal. He was a robber baron. James J. Hill was a hero. And there's a big difference between, I would call these other types of people, the Edward Collins, the Durants, the Leland Stanfords, I'd call them political entrepreneurs. They don't, and I would call the Cornelius Vanderbilts, the James J. Hills, I call them more economic entrepreneurs. They were, you know, they were businessmen. They wanted to, and in a free market, you can't survive. You can't make a profit unless you can find a way to serve the mass market. You can't make a living. Well, I guess there is some kind of a living. There's a niche market out there for serving rich people, but
there's a niche market for pirates.
Yeah, but there's the real market, the one that you can get very wealthy on, is you have to serve the masses.
Yeah, Andrew Carnegie, when building, you know, when operating a railroad steel mill kind of thing, he says to make 1 ton of steel, 1.5 tons of ironstone has to be mined. It has to be transported by a rail 100 miles to the lakes. It has to be carried by boat hundreds of miles and transferred back to cars and then transported by rail 150 miles to Pittsburgh. How then could steel be manufactured and sold without loss at £3 for 2 cents? This, I confess, seems incredible to me, but it is so. Now think about that, £3 of steel for 2 cents. And it's because he's serving the masses. He's not serving the special interests. He's actually producing these great services for people, and he can sell it cheaply because there's this enormous demand. You have to keep supplying demand in the forefront.
I think we've run out of time. Good night, everybody. Thank you for tuning in. See you next week.
See you guys.